They may have even been living here when the explorers first came in to the Kotzebue Sound, before there was any kind of actual European or physical European contact.
Archaeologists dig at a unique site in Northwest Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a look at how salmon affect the entire ecosystem.
They are like conveyor belts of fertilizers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A team of archaeologists from Brown University have uncovered a native village site in northwest Alaska that dates from just before first contact. The village is one of the biggest archaeological sites discovered in the Arctic. Local Inupiaq residents hope the research will tell them more about their ancestors. KSKA's Daisha Eaton visited the dig and has this report.
It's a short walk from the banks of the Kobuk River to a mosquito-infested clearing where archaeologists from Brown University have been uncovering the village. With a white beard and a multi-pocketed khaki jacket, Dr. Doug Anderson points to a large depression in the ground, which he says was once a house. He specializes in the prehistory and early history of Northwest Alaska. In his 50-plus year career as an Arctic archaeologist, Anderson says he's never seen a village quite like this one, with so many houses connected by a web of tunnels.
In some other places here, we've found maybe two houses that are connected by tunnels, but nothing like this. And in other areas, those houses are really quite small compared to the houses here. These are gigantic houses.
The dwellings are the size of a typical one-room cabin and dug about 4 feet down into the earth, framed by spruce beams and poles with sod and earth walls and a fireplace at the center. The depression is dotted with little orange flags marking the spots where crews found artifacts. The dig is located within Kobuk Valley National Park, about 20 or so river miles up the Kobuk from Kiana. From what he can tell, Anderson believes the village was a regional capital with an estimated population of around 200 people. Through radiocarbon dating, researchers found the village dates from the late 1700s or the early 1800s, just before official contact with explorers.
They may have even been living here when the explorers first came in to the Kotzebue Sound. There's a little bit of metal and even some glass beads here before there was any kind of actual European or physical European contact.
Anderson says he has a lot of questions about how the artifacts got there. Alaska natives didn't make glass beads or metal, so they had to come from the outside. They may have come in through trading with Asian tribes who crossed the Bering Strait, Anderson says, or possibly through trading with interior Alaska native tribes. Edward Cleofe is an undergraduate student at Brown who spent the summer working at the site. He's touring a group around the dig. He stands around an excavated house with the group.
What you see here, when you look down, most of the house was actually underground. They put posts up. You can see a post right there, or a little chunk of a post there. So those house posts held up the roof, which was made out of sod. You can actually see some of the sod blocks that we've made and or recovered right over there. So these people were living underground to stay really, really warm. So these people were living here probably during the winter. Can everyone see the big fireplace? You can see the three walls of the stone.
As Cleofe explains, researchers found signs that the people who lived in the village kept dogs.
Does anyone know what coprolites are? That's a fancy archaeology term for poop. We found a bunch of dog poop right over there full of fish bones and fish scales and fish things. And we've also found a lot of dog bones in this area. So there's quite a bit of evidence that says that these people were living very closely with their dogs.
Researchers also found two sets of human remains in a dwelling, one adult male with a broken leg and one young child. Stories from local residents tell of attacks by Indians from the interior on the village and of possible food shortages. Thomas Jackson says that when he was a child, his mother told him that his ancestors had lived at an old village in the area. She said,
You're descendant from these people. That's the first time I've heard of this as a child. She said from Hunt River on down to coal mine area. And that's where the village, the large village, is at.
Jackson is a member of the Kiana Traditional Council, which is working with Brown and the Park Service to ensure the project moves forward. Elders also told Jackson a few things that had been passed down to them about the people who lived in the village, and they gave him its name.
Igliktirsirligrok, which was a large village. All what we know about that place, what the people talked about, were that of skillful people, a place of strong shamanism X, a strong dog.
Kiana resident Deba Barr visited the site. She says learning about the people who could be her ancestors fills her with pride.
It's a little bit overwhelming when you see all the stuff and all the hard work that they did compared to how we live now.
She wants to know, what did they eat? How did they travel? And how did they build the houses? That last one is something researchers would like to know too. But curiously, they didn't find any tools at the site, so how they built the subterranean dwellings remains a mystery. Local residents say they plan to donate their DNA to check against the remains of the people found at the site. The remains will eventually be returned to tribal leaders for burial. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Republican Bill Walker announced plans today to run as an unaffiliated candidate for governor next year if he gathers the required signatures to qualify. Walker would avoid a primary with Governor Sean Parnell and get his name on the November general election ballot. Walker, in a statement, said it seems to him that if you don't support the oil tax cut recently passed by the legislature and championed by Parnell, then you're not considered, quote, a good Republican. He said that while he'll remain a traditional Alaska Republican, it's time to put party politics aside and, quote, aggressively pursue what is in the best interests of Alaskans. Walker is a former mayor of Valdez, known for his support of an all-Alaska natural gas pipeline. The state spends nearly $2 billion on its public school system every year. But despite that, districts across Alaska come up against layoffs and strapped budgets. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that a newly formed legislative task force plans to review the state of education in Alaska.
Representative Lynn Gaddis says the task force will operate as sort of an audit for how well Alaska is educating its students.
I anticipate nothing being off the table.
Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican, is one of the co-chairs of the Sustainable Education Task Force. She says the group will be meeting about a dozen times over the next few months to look at how public schools are being funded. Gaddis says the group will also talk about where charter schools fit into the education system and if Alaska should consider vouchers. The Alaska Constitution prohibits the public funding of private schools, but an amendment to change that was introduced in the legislature last session. Gaddis, along with her co-chair Tammy Wilson, announced their appointments to the task force today, and she says they intentionally went beyond just educators. For example, Representative Charisse Millett, who heads up the House Energy Committee, was chosen to look at schools' heating costs. Brad Keithley, an oil and gas consultant, was selected to look at how education spending fits into the state's overall budget. Andrew Halcrow, a former legislator and gubernatorial candidate who now heads up the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, was picked for the other business seat. Jerry Covey, a former education commissioner under Wally Hickel, and David Knees, a math teacher who has run for Anchorage School Board, were selected for the educator slots. Andy Baker of Kotzebue will represent the state's rural communities. Ron Furr is the president of the teachers' union, NEA Alaska, and he says that while he's glad that the legislature is giving education an extra look.
Well, I have some reservations that what they're looking at is going to be in the best interest of Alaska's public school students.
Furr says he's surprised that no current teachers or superintendents were picked to serve on the task force, even though many applied.
There's no one on the task force who brings today's classroom experiences.
Gaddis says the decision to exclude working educators was a conscious one, because she had concerns that they wouldn't be able to speak frankly.
I wanted folks to be retired or out of the system, so they could say, you know, when I was in the system, here's what didn't work. Here's where we spent a lot of money, and quite frankly, it was a waste.
The task force's first meeting is tentatively scheduled for August. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, living with a terminal illness.
I can walk up and down the stairs. I can go shopping at the grocery store. You know, I can play with, you know, my dogs, and they're enormous.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
A new study finds evidence of increasing wildfire frequency. University of Illinois PhD candidate Ryan Kelly's project analyzed drill cores from the bottom of lakes in the Yukon Flats. The cores provide a record of sediment accumulation dating back 10,000 years, including charcoal particles deposited by wildfires. Kelly says they show increased occurrence of fire.
At no time in the past was there ever a fire regime as active as that of the last few decades. The fire frequency of the last few decades in the Yukon Flats is around one fire every 50 years. That's quite high for any boreal forest region, and that's about twice as high as the average fire frequency for the past several millennia, which was around 100 years in between fires.
Numerous other studies have linked the recent increase in wildfires to the warming climate, and Kelly says his study corroborates that. He says the drill cores also show increased fire activity during the Middle Ages, a period of known warming, but the interval between fires did not change then. He says the current climate trend exceeds the warming in the Middle Ages, and succession from black spruce to deciduous trees may not be enough to stop wildfire frequency from increasing in the boreal forest.
In the same way that the climate system is being pushed beyond anything that has occurred in the recent past, the fire regime might also be entering just kind of a completely novel state. So even the deciduous forest might start to burn more than we've seen in the past.
Kelly says the Yukon Flats were selected for study because they have seen the most increase in wildfire frequency. The boreal forest holds abundant carbon, which is released to the atmosphere when it burns, adding to warming. University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor of Forestry Scott Rupp collaborated on research that led to Kelly's study. Rupp says the use of drill cores has enabled an understanding of fire frequency way beyond the 50 to 100 years of observational data that's been previously available.
And one of the reasons this is so critical is this is the exact sort of data that's required for the development and testing of models that are being used here in Alaska to simulate future conditions under different climate scenarios.
Rupp says the data is also immediately useful for decision-making by resource managers, including on wildfire suppression. A researcher in Bristol Bay is working to better understand the micronutrients that are essential for aquatic ecosystems. Salmon are well known to be a big source of the nutrients, but scientists are learning that a slightly less delicious organism plays a huge role in the health of salmon-producing streams and lakes. KDLG's Ben Matheson has the story.
The final stage of a salmon's life isn't especially glamorous. After laying eggs, they're exhausted and about done. When they reach their pre-programmed destination, they die, and in a final gift to the world, their bodies decompose and release critical nutrients.
They are like conveyor belts of fertilizers.
Denise Devota is a PhD student at the University of Illinois. She's in Dillingham this summer as part of a multi-year project to better understand the nutrients in the watershed of the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge.
And it's amazing how far these nutrients get into the forests. There are a couple of studies that show that the nitrogen from salmon can be found more than 3 miles into the forest interior from the edge of the stream.
She's paying very close attention to two elements, nitrogen and phosphorus.
Out of all the elements that we have, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, molybdenum, who knows what, these two are the most limiting amongst any biological organisms we have in the subarctic or in the Arctic up here. It's nitrogen and phosphorus. Those are the two big ones. If we add those two nutrients, life would flourish.
On the banks and hills of the Bristol Bay area are large patches of alder. It's not as romantic as a spawning salmon, but alder's a very big deal in terms of nutrients.
It's so fascinating in southwestern Alaska that 40% of the vegetation cover in this region
is comprised of alder. And that is expanding. Satellite images of this region have shown that under climate warming, alder has been expanding northward. It's been creeping up slopes, getting larger and larger and covering more space.
Devota's project aims to measure alder's capacity to contribute those essential nutrients. She's studying 26 streams and 13 lakes. With a great deal of support from the staff at the Togiak Refuge, Devota flies out to lakes and streams. She measures water depth and velocity twice a year. She collects a few liters of water and drops in sediment traps. Those go back to Illinois to be analyzed in the lab. She can tell to some degree which nutrients come from fish and which from alder, based on a few different isotopes and statistical models.
We are seeing that in our streams, alder is a major contributor of nitrogen. So that's really exciting. For our lakes, that's where the story gets even more complex and exciting, because lakes are more complex. They bring in nutrients from all across the watershed. They integrate that and bring that to one spot. And we're seeing that in the lakes, salmon and alder, both of them are contributing to not only more nitrogen and phosphorus, but more life as well. And what I mean by more life is that we're seeing more algae, more zooplankton, which are little critters, that they're like insects in the water that baby salmon feed on and other fish feed on.
Everything is still preliminary, but Devota says the study has potential implications to future salmon management.
And what this study aims to do is it wants to answer the question of, if we have alder in the watershed that we know is a fertilizer, do we still need as many salmon escaping upstream? Can we reduce that number because alder is contributing nutrients to the lakes and the streams? And given that alder is set to expand in area, this is going to be a critical question to answer.
In Dillingham, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Fairbanks residents turned out strongly earlier this week to speak out on natural gas service applications. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska held a hearing as part of its review of applications from Fairbanks Natural Gas and the borough's Interior Gas Utility. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, cheaper, cleaner energy is at stake.
Fairbanks Natural Gas, a private company that currently serves 1,100 customers in the core area of Fairbanks, has applied to expand its service area, while the recently formed public Interior Gas Utility has applied to provide service in an overlapping area that includes North Pole and other suburban parts of the borough. Dozens testified at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska hearing, agreeing that expanded gas service is needed to reduce the cost of energy and improve air quality, but opinions differed on the FNG and IGU applications. Fairbanks resident and business owner Mick Killian was one of several who spoke against giving Fairbanks Natural Gas a monopoly.
I don't think the Fairbanks Natural Gas has honored their commitments to the community, and I'm not sure that you people have policed them properly. In 2004, the Pentex application to acquire Fairbanks Natural Gas stated that they would add 115 miles of distribution, have 5,800 customers by 2013. They have 20% of that.
Fairbanks Natural Gas has struggled with a limited gas supply from Cook Inlet. The company and the IGU are mobilizing now following state legislative approval this spring of hundreds of millions of dollars in financing for a project to truck in gas from the North Slope. Others who testified at the RCA hearing spoke well of FNG, saying the company has the infrastructure and experience to expand service quickly and strategically. Longtime Fairbanks resident Julie Duquette told the commission private industry is a better source of gas.
My concern is that the government gas utility will expand distribution to locations that are not cost-effective and cause rate increase for everyone.
Duquette also expressed concern that the IGU will rely too heavily on state support for laying distribution lines at a time when additional funding will be hard to come by. Another testifier, John Cook, chief financial officer for J&J Development, which owns several Fairbanks big box store properties served by Fairbanks Natural Gas, said adding another gas utility would be a bad thing.
And looking at the applications that you have in front of you, I guess one thing I have a hard time getting my hand around is how having two competing entities with duplicative plant and duplicative general and administrative costs will be less expensive to the consumers, businesses. That just, as a CPA, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Cook said getting expanded gas service quickly is key to securing pending large retail development. Longtime Fairbanks plumbing and heating contractor Jim Gibbertoni spoke on behalf of Fairbanks residents he said need gas the most.
I've sat here and watched Fairbanks natural gas come in, and that was a good thing. But I also watched the pipeline go over to Box Heaven and just bypass my subdivision and many other subdivisions. And the last time I read certain documents in this country, it says we the people. It does no good to bring the gas to the cherry pick to the high profit people if you aren't going to bring it to the people of Fairbanks, the actual people. I'm talking about running down the intersections and going into the subdivisions and bringing gas to the people that make $40,000 or $50,000 a year. Those are the ones that need it more than anyone. Those are the ones burning the wood.
Several people expressed hope that FNG and the IGU can partner to expand gas service. The IGU was formed by local government to facilitate getting gas to more borough residents, acting as a nonprofit, tax-free financing conduit. Input from the session will be considered by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to make a decision on FNG and the IGU's service applications. A ruling is due in October. Many who testified urged the commission to expedite the process. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Don Dillard never wanted to retire. The 57-year-old expected to keep working as a public advocacy lawyer until she turned 100. But last year, a diagnosis of uterine cancer forced her into retirement. Now her full-time job is fighting terminal cancer. And she says even if the disease kills her, she doesn't want it to defeat her. APRN's Annie Feit has this profile.
The cancer that's killing Dawn Dillard has left her sense of humor very much intact. She greets me at the door of her Kenai home wearing a black shirt that reads, "I'm not dead yet."
Hello.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, good to see you too.
You don't have to take your shoes off. Okay.
Dillard lives in a split-level house in Kenai with her husband Ron, two gigantic dogs, and three ferrets, Whitey, Chunk, and Chum.
Chum's the oldest. The dark one is the oldest. Come here, bud. Looky there.
Don met Ron doing community theater in Bethel in 1998. They married 5 years ago on snow machines in spring as the last snow was melting from the tundra. In some ways, they're opposites. Ron is tall with long, wavy hair, a gray beard, and red suspenders. Physically, he's a big presence, but a quiet one. Dawn is much smaller, but she has a light-up-the-room personality and is always cracking jokes with a slightly devious twinkle in her eye. The couple expected to grow old together. Then Dawn caught a basic cold in January 2012. Weeks went by. She visited a doctor several times, but never got better. Finally, she asked for a PAP screening. It's supposed to be an annual exam, but Dawn says she had skipped it for at least 5 years.
I would just put it off. I'm like, yeah, I know I need to do this, but I'm going on vacation next month. Or I know I need to do this, but I've got a big trial coming up. And, you know, it was something that I just kept pushing back in the back of my mind. I knew I needed to do it, but I didn't.
By this time, Dawn knew something was seriously wrong, and the tests confirmed it. She had uterine cancer. She had to fly to Anchorage for more tests to find out it had metastasized to her liver and abdomen. A gynecologist recommended starting chemotherapy right away.
And I said, well, I don't know that I want to do chemotherapy. What other options do I have? And he said, well, if you do nothing, you'll be dead in 2 months.
Since that day, Don's life has been a blur of blood draws, surgeries, procedures, and doctor's appointments, along with chemotherapy. She's lost track of the exact number of chemo sessions she's had. She and Ron moved to Kenai in February, in part so she could be closer to a treatment center.
I need to get your weight and blood pressure whenever you're ready.
After a quick visit with a doctor at Katmai Oncology in Soldotna, Dawn settles into a beige recliner for 2 hours of chemotherapy. She jokes with the nurse about the name of the chemo drug dripping into her vein, Topotecan.
I dream about it. Doesn't it sound like it ought to be a Caribbean island?
Topotecan. Totally. Good.
Instead of a horrible medicine that makes you feel rotten.
Topotecan.
When she first started chemo, a doctor told Dawn she could expect to live about a year. She beat that prediction by at least 5 months, and she's hopeful the latest round of chemotherapy will make a difference. But at this point, she's happier not knowing her prognosis.
Part of me does want to know, but for the most part, I don't. Right now, I feel strong. I feel like, I can walk up and down the stairs. I can go shopping at the grocery store. You know, I can play with, my dogs, and they're enormous. And I don't feel weak.
Dawn says the hardest thing about living with a terminal illness is the uncertainty. She wants to go to San Francisco or maybe even Hawaii, but doesn't know how far ahead she should book the flights. The main priority right now, though, is spending time with Ron. She says she can't imagine going through cancer without him. He's always at her side.
We'll take care of her. They'll take care of her. And the world keeps turning because she's here.
Yeah. This must be really hard on both of you, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
But, it's something about that to happen, the whole thing. So... I've got her.
As for the future, Dawn hates the phrase taking it a day at a time. She prefers to say she's winging it and just trying to enjoy life. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Matheson in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.